still in recess.
One moment.
I'm here.
Anyway, let's get her done.
Thank you. Senator.
Yep.
Hi, Senator.
How are you, sir?
I'm good.
Click the hammer. Click the hammer.
She hit the hammer and then disappeared.
That's why I came in.
Was it Lex?
No, it was Barb. I told her, I said, you're in a hurry. You've got the gavel. Reconvene. She said, that's right. I forgot. So she reconvenes and leaves. I tell you what, I could grab that baby. Thanks, Lee.
You know, before you do that amendment, you might say, you know, Senator Lance, we know that this is hard. We know you try to do a job. But here's one aspect that you really need to look at, which is that fireman's deal.
Warren is Warren's going to do it. Warren, I've already talked.
Me too.
That's legit.
The Judiciary Committee will come to order. Ms. Honey?
Chair Goodwin, I don't think I've ever cleared a room like that before. Was it something I said? Or?
Not at all your fault.
Oh, thank you. My name is Kathy Honey, and I am a lawyer at Fagry Baker Daniels, and I represent the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We're 450 chiefs of police and additional law enforcement leaders, and I really just want to take 1 minute and say thank you for Senator Latz and committee for including the crisis intervention training funding in the bill, because it is something that we feel very strongly about. We did a survey, and Chair Goodwin knows this because we've talked about it, but we did a survey last November of our members, and 95% of those who responded have stated that they've seen a large increase in mental health-related calls over the last 5 years, and many of our chiefs saying that more than 50% of an increase has kind of shown up in their calls. So we had recommended, and we're very pleased to see funding for crisis intervention training in the bill. And I see Senator Carlson is here, too, our bill author, so that was really great. Many thanks. It's been shown through research that this training is really, in de-escalation techniques, is very effective and is shown to reduce injuries or death to both officers and people with mental illness. So, again, thanks to Senator Latz and Senator Carlson and the committee.
Did I miss a thank you?
You did. Darn it.
Yeah, one good thing.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Ms. Honey, I want to say that I have heard nothing but good things about the crisis intervention training as I've gone around the state on mental health issues. And I really appreciate hearing from officers about how well that works and what a great program it is. And so I'm glad we were able to fund that. It's very important. All right. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I'd like to know if the representative from the East African Women's Organization is present. And
somebody here from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Is that you?
I'm Farheel Khalif. I'm with the Voice of East African Women.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Farheel Khalif, I am with the Voice of the East African.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committees. I am Farheel Khalif, and I'm here to thank and to get the support of the committee. I want to thank you, our Senator Carlson, for your support, and Senator Letts for your consideration for us to be considered for this funding. I want to talk about the East Africans' urgent need. This is the first East African shelter in the state of Minnesota. I'm aware of there's some wonderful people out there who want to help women and children from the East African. This is a community that's a culture appropriated. The shelter is going to help women and children who usually goes to other shelters, but this will help them culturally, religionally. This is the first East African shelter. We know there's other shelters around in the state of Minnesota, including Harriet Tubman, who we reach out to them and kindly open their doors, who we get trainings for them weekly, and our staff, where there's a lot of volunteers coming in, the East African, eager to go and get the help. So when the shelter opens up, which almost is done, when we first got the building, we did not know the building had a lot of needs, a rehab, including sprinkles, and the city of St. Paul has to come in and to do, they have to break down this historic street that we have to pay lots of money for to add it on the water, because the sprinkle did not come in with the building that is going to be emergency shelter for up to 16 families. I'm aware of it. There's a lot of, like I said, a wonderful organization who like to be, we like to be under them. But this is need is so urgent and it's different. As a culture, when a mother is needed help and she is not a typical woman that you could use to go into regular shelters, she will find these programs and trainings for this East African shelter Similar like welcoming home. When a mother is stressed out and she's reaching out to and out their shelters, she will not get the support she will get it from this East African and shelter. The reason is Sunday there's a woman was killed in the Somali community in Minneapolis. Woman is going down to the domestic abuse center where we are helping her because now she will not openly freely talk about because she's afraid. I'm here to ask you support to consider to increase the funding. And I'm really just asking you for your support. We are new. This is cultural needed shelter. It's very urgent. And as I said, we have a couple of shelters who's been around over 40 years, like Cornerstone, Harry Tubman. We are under their wings, are helping us, supporting us. So I'm really grateful to you all support. I have other to testify if you guys need more. But I'm grateful. I'm just here to present to the East African community shelters the urgent need for us East African women.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions, members? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam, I looked over your proposal, and I had one question. We usually don't make culturally specific shelters for just about any program that we have. Why is this need so acute that it needs that type of focus for only East African women?
Because when we go, when we come in together and we open in the shelter, emergency shelter, we will provide the programs that they will get it from their own households. Women can open up because there's a lot of urgent need for women when they, the man, okay, the state of Minnesota does have man to marry only one woman, right? So the man, some man is still practicing marrying more than one wife, and the woman is to be left alone. If she goes to the, some other shelters, where I'm sure over 400 or more shelters is around, she will have a place to spend the night high and her children, but she will not get the empowerment and the trainings and the programs that she will get from this appropriated emergency shelter, where it's the East African woman who can come in, not only the culture, but also the religion and the food practice. And you will see when you go to some places, you always look the menu and you say, is this food part of the halal food? When you come to this shelter, you will be getting this focus appropriate because of it feels like home. She can open up to us. I'm her. I know my father had four wives. I had three aunties. My father had over 30 children. So I'm sure things will change over the years. I don't know how long it will take when a woman get empowered and step up and educate herself and realize she can say this is enough. To do that, she will have to have a home when she can walk in. It feels like she is at her own house. It smells like it. People are feel like culturally, religiously appropriate. So the need is urgent because the funding is not out there for us to get it. Office of Justice Programs already appropriated the funding up to 2017. The other shelters is around right now. It's been getting funding over the years. So as of first, there's a Latino shelter, Asian women's shelter, African-American shelter, Caucasian shelter, but there's no specifically East African woman shelter in the state of Minnesota. This is the first East African woman.
Okay. You okay with that?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess
Limmer.
Maybe I've been missing something in how we've been developing women's shelters around the Twin Cities. I don't remember them to be culturally specific. Maybe I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, yes, there are few different culture appropriate shelters, including I just mentioned like the La Casa Esperanza is culture appropriate, Harriet Tubman is culture appropriate, Asian Woman United is culture appropriate, and several other shelters are culture appropriate. But at the same time, they are just like us. We are not discriminating. Anybody is open to anybody who walks in. Any bed that is open for the night, it will be welcome. Any culture, any religion, it doesn't matter who it is.
But I think, Senator Limmer, that they're catering more to women that have a very different life circumstance than what others have. And if they have four wives and 30 children and have culturally specific food, they're not going to feel comfortable with a group of people that are basically white and have their own food. And they're gonna when they tell their stories, they're going to feel really unusually different instead of feeling like they have people that understand their cultural issues.
I think Senator Disick has a name.
Senator Disick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer, so I represent Cedar Riverside, which has a lot of Somalis, and we there are issues in the women's shelter, and then actually we're running into where we have some kids or younger adults that are homeless, and that's what I've spent a lot of time in the last few months working on, and they are just not going to your youth link and your other homeless shelters. There's just a barrier, and as Ms. Ferriu said, that you know it might take a few years, and I think they will eventually get there, and I know they're not discriminating, but it's just, you know, sometimes there just are big differences, and they're just not going. I mean, we have people reaching out to them. St. Stephen's is reaching out to them in that homeless area, and they're just not going. And so I think it is just people want to go where they feel comfortable. And so, as she said again, they don't discriminate. If there are barriers to get women into shelters, and if some of the cultural and the religion and the food issues are out there, and if that keeps them going, I would rather have something where they can feel a little more at home, because they are, I mean, going to a shelter is a traumatic situation. So I think if we just need to make them comfortable, I think that it is helpful. And again, in a few years, I think they would be, you know, like everybody else. My grandparents came from Poland, and, you know, I think they kind of stuck in their own little community, and now you don't notice that at all. So I think that's just what this is. So.
All right. Any other questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. If you would please sign the wherever it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes. And thank you all members of the committees. Thank you.
All right. Then we have Ms. Knoyer. Am I slaughtering your name?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Yvonne Knoyer, and I'm the Prevention Program Manager for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I'm here, I wanted to thank Chair Latz and the committee for including both the policy language and the funding for the sexual assault prevention grants. And I just wanted to draw your attention to two things and to clarify two things. First, the policy language that is included on page 28.30 articulates that these grants are targeted, dedicated specifically to primary prevention. And second, I want to clarify that this is not a directed appropriation. This funding is awarded through a competitive grant process, and that the grantees are accountable to OJP. So again, I just want to appreciate and support the chair's recommendations to add the policy language and the policy language, which builds on the first-time state appropriation for primary prevention that was made during the last session at the legislature.
Thank you, Ms. Knoyer. Any questions from the members?
Could you
Senator Dietzick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you repeat what page you were talking about?
It was on page 2830. It just is the section 18, I believe it is, or section 16. What this language does is it puts into statute the intent that the legislature intended from some funding that was awarded through the budgetary process in 2014.
All right. Everybody okay with that? Thank you very much for your testimony. Please remember to sign in. I've been forgetting to tell people that, but we need the names. And Senator Latz?
Are there any further testifiers, Madam?
Yes, are there any further testifiers on any of the issues in the finance bill? Seeing none, Senator Latz.
Everything has been said that needs to be said.
At least one.
As this committee and stakeholders in the room know, I have not been shy about making proposals that generate reaction, and I have not been reticent to take into consideration the feedback that I get. Sometimes I have time to lay bills over and factor in input, and sometimes I don't. And today is one of the days I don't, because this bill is going to be up in the full Finance Committee tomorrow. So we're going to make some adjustments on the fly here. I am very sympathetic to a lot of the testimony that we had here, a lot of worthy programs, a lot of places I'd like to add more funding, but I just don't see that we have the ability within our budget to do that. And as and that includes, you know, I go way back with the Office for Justice Programs groups as well. I was vice chair to Senator Higgins when she chaired the Public Safety Division when I was first elected into the Senate. So I'm quite familiar with the needs there. I think, at least for now, I'm not convinced that there's enough of a case made for backfilling additional funding into the Office of Justice Programs right now. There may be some individual circumstances where I'm wrong on that, and candidly, there'll be opportunities further down in the process to revisit some of these numbers. But I'm also cognizant that whatever changes I make in the bill to try to fill in areas that I think deserve more funding, I'd have to take funding out of someone else that I also think deserves funding, and that this committee, in its wisdom in the end, I think will believe deserves funding. And so there are a lot of moving parts here. But as the firefighters in the room know, that I have for many years believed that it was not appropriate to take money out of the fire safety account because the money was raised to go into that account for the specific purposes. But unfortunately, this budget is under some pressure. I don't think the target was generous enough for us to be able to meet the needs of all of those stakeholders that came in here looking for funding. And, you know, we heard the BCA say they need more funding into their labs and for personnel to meet the expanding demand for forensic and digital and electronic investigation and the expanding needs with the new kinds of criminal investigative tools that are available. And we heard others come in and say they need more money too. And we just can't deal with all of that. But where I think we may have some room to maneuver here to meet at least the needs with regard and the concerns with regard to using the funds that were allocated from the fire safety account. And by the way, I want to say one more thing. I do not believe that anyone in this room, and I do not believe that I personally have in any way breached any kind of an agreement that was made in the past. And frankly, I resent that the accusation was made. There's no breach here. There's $10 million in ongoing money that's going to be there, plus in ongoing money that's going to be there in years for the future that are a result of that agreement. What we have here is one-time funding, money that hasn't been used in the past that's available this time. And I don't think that in particular was a part of any agreement that was made several years ago. But that said, I do want to try to respect the overall intent of the purpose of that fee on insurance that was collected for the general purpose of firefighter training. I'm not going to give you a legal opinion on whether or not that funding is appropriate to ongoing salaries or program needs or equipment or anything like that. I'm not sure that the intent was to create an ongoing funding source for statewide, generally for statewide firefighting activities. But I'm not going to render an opinion on that because that's going to be beyond my scope today. What I think we can do, and we'll let others in this building sort out the implications of this, I think we can take back from the disaster contingency fund the several million dollars that were used to put money into the disaster contingency fund that was allocated out of the fire safety account and put it back into the fire safety account. And we can use some of the money that we left on the bottom line in the fire safety account, so they'll be left with almost nothing in the bank account at the end, but we can allocate it specifically instead of leaving it there. So there's about $1.4 million on the bottom line unallocated in the fire safety account under the current proposal. There is $5 million in the disaster contingency account, which I propose that we take $4 million and put that into the fire safety account. And then we can use the $1.4 million to allocate specifically to the training, the new training line, education and training line above the $2 million that's there for the biennium right now. So the fire safety training will go from $5.4 million. You can add another $3.4 million to that. Now, this is a very significant increase over existing training dollars. No matter how you cut the fact that the money came in from a particular source. So there should be plenty of money there for firefighter training in the next biennium. And then my understanding is from the numbers that I understand to be requested for the air rescue and Minnesota Task Force One, we ought to be able to provide one-time funding for those lines at the amounts requested. And honestly, I don't know how much of that, if any, is going to end up going toward equipment. And candidly, I'm just not going to ask that question anymore because I don't know if that would qualify or not. But we'll put that money into those accounts. And, you know, if there's a desire to backfill the disaster contingency fund from some other source, then the full finance committee or the full legislature or somewhere else on the bottom line in this big state budget of ours can be used for that, or we'll come back in special session if we end up using up more than the $1 million that I propose now to leave in that account. So that's my proposal, $4 million moved from the disaster contingency fund back to the fire safety account, then reallocate money within the fire safety account, as I mentioned.
All right, members, that would be on page 15, but perhaps we can have Mr. Turner tell us what that change would be specifically.
Yeah. Mr. Turner's prepared a more specific description.
Madam Chair and members, and my colleague Ken Backus, do you have this? I'd like you to take down what I say as well. I'm going to speak to the spreadsheet rather than the bill. On the spreadsheet on line 96, that's the disaster contingency account, strike 5,000 in 2006 and or 5 million. 2006 and insert 1 million. That gives
2016,
right. Sorry. That gives the committee $4 million. And Senator Latz proposes on line 270 to strike $6,500,000 on the transfer and insert $2,500,000. Then,
excuse me, Madam Chair, Mr. Turner, one more time.
Senator Newman.
Strike the fire safety transfer from $6.5 million to $2.5 million. Okay. Now the general fund is balanced.
Did you mean, Mr. Turner, am I getting mixed up here, or did you mean change 3.25 to 2.5 for each year? Is that what you meant?
Madam Chair, there's a $6.5 million on the fiscal year 16-17.
I'm sorry. Senator Lance, would you repeat that, please?
In the column under the chairman's recommendation for FY16-17,
right.
17, there's a $6.5 million entry. That should be $2.5 million. And then in under the individual 16 and 17-year columns, it should be 1.25. Is it 1,250,000 each of those? So change the 3 to a 1.
Okay, then there are no riders in the bill right now. We will create 3 riders. The first rider will be $1,700,000 each year for firefighter training and education. That will be ongoing money. So it bumps the current proposal up $700,000 in ongoing money each year for firefighter training, for a total increase of 1.7 each year, or a total increase for the bill now of $3.4 million in ongoing money. Then there'll be 2 one-time riders. And the first will be $1,110,000 each year for Minnesota Task Force 1. And the second will be $190,000 each year for Minnesota Air Rescue.
That's one for the 190 for the biennium, or 190 each year?
190 each year, 380 for the biennium. And that, by doing it this way with the ongoing and the one time, the tails for the entire fire safety account, the total appropriation for 18 and 19 will be $10,197,000 each year, $3,000 less than the projected income. So we've balanced the general fund and we've balanced the fire safety account.
Questions, members? All right. Are you offering that as an amendment, Senator Latz?
So moved.
So moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Did we want to hear from anybody over there? No? All right. All right. Thank you, Senator Latz. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify?
Let's move this bill.
I believe we're finished, Senator Newman. So any questions on the whole bill from here? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. I want to recognize how hard you and Mr. Turner have worked on this. And I also recognize that it's an impossible task to keep everybody happy. But I do have a couple of items that I just want to raise, and a couple of things I want to ask a question on. First of all, insofar as the court system is concerned, and I haven't seen it in here. Is there money in here for that e-filing that the court was requesting?
Senator Latz.
There isn't any money.
I was unable to find it, so that's the reason I'm asking.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, no, there is not any new money specifically for e-filing.
That answers that question.
Senator Newman.
I just wanted to visit for a minute, Senator Latz, about the BCA. And I have made my feelings concerning the BCA that, you know, you know, with forensics being what they are today and things are changing, and we have items like, you know, DNA and whatnot that are really being beneficial towards solving crimes. And that really is a primary function for us in this committee. And I look at, for instance, the amount of increase on a percentage basis that the guardian ad litems are receiving. And then they come to the table and complain because they don't get enough. When, in point of fact, I think the guardian ad litems were getting something like 13% overall in terms of an increase, and it really surprises me because that is a group that a few years ago was not a state agency or a state board. It was independent contractors, and before that it was volunteers. And it is getting to be a very, very expensive board for us. And when I see the kind of increase there they are, number one, asking for, and number two, granted, I simply question that. I mean, for instance, on this employee parity, they got 5 and 5. I mean, that is a significant increase. The other area that got what I consider an awfully significant increase is the Human Rights Department. Now, granted, that's really an important department. Senator Latz, they received, I think, 7 new FTEs, and overall have got an increase of 18.8%. And no matter how you stretch it, you know, with, for instance, an awful lot of agencies and departments receiving an increase of, say, 1.8%, 18.8% really begins to strike me as being awfully generous. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention that with the BCA being an agency that really can help us in terms of protecting the public safety, I question those kinds of percentage of increases for those two particular items. The last thing that I wanted to just bring to your attention, you may or may not be aware of this, I'm honestly not sure, but in the Finance Committee this morning, there was an appropriation coming directly from the Attorney General's office in the amount of $65,000 for the purposes of a grant to the County Attorneys Association for prosecutor and law enforcement training. And a very, very similar funding is in this bill. I think it's $100,000 per year for the next 2 years for the same thing. And at least, I don't know about law enforcement, but for the training for the prosecutors for essentially CLEs. You and I have been paying for our own CLEs for an awful long time. And I now see funding coming in your bill for that very purpose, and another funding source coming out of the Attorney General's office for the same purpose. And I question whether or not, maybe we could take that $200,000, for instance, and slide it towards that the children's program that was earlier described in the Office of Justice, the youth intervention. That seems to me to be a very, very worthwhile program, one that obviously we cannot fund to the extent that they are asking. But would I rather spend a couple of $100,000 on youth intervention or providing training from two different sources to prosecutors to teach them about new laws. You know, we lawyers, we have the ability to do that on our own, I think. And so those, Senator Latz, would be, you know, just my observations on the bill. Again, I want to thank you for putting this together. But, you know, of course, we're never going to agree on everything. But those are my observations on a couple of areas that I find troubling. So thank you very much, Senator
Newman. On the crisis intervention training for police, I went to the Sheriff's Association meeting, and they said that one of the sheriffs said, or police chiefs, I don't know which, from the Duluth area, said that if he trained every single one of his officers, it would cost much more than $200,000 for the biennium. Because I proposed $200,000 in my bill. That's not, you know, not going to go too far. But not for this committee, for Health and Human Services. But anyway, so I think the quicker we can get people law enforcement trained when they have so many people that they run across with mental illness. But I don't know if, and maybe Senator Latz knows whether or not this is the same kind of training in the other bill. What bill did you say that was in?
Well, Madam Chair, what I am referring to is a bill that is in the state government finance bill.
For the Attorney General's office?
And it is funding for training for county attorneys, for prosecutors and law enforcement, and specifically to train them regarding laws that we pass.
Oh, that's good.
And I believe the same funding is coming at line 158 in our bill for the same purpose. And, you know, is it enough? Well, probably not to train law enforcement and prosecutors statewide if we total up both. But as I stated, we have been paying for our own CLEs for a very long time. And I am seeing what I think is a duplication. Now, maybe it's intentional and legitimate, and maybe it isn't, but I am seeing what I think. Funding coming out of the state government bill and out of the judiciary finance bill for the same purpose. And I am simply questioning whether or not we couldn't take the $200,000 that is in our bill to train prosecutors and slide it over to the youth intervention program, which I think is really a very worthwhile program. And then we'll let the prosecutors and law enforcement figure out how to train themselves on the new laws. They'll figure it out. They're fully grown.
To that point, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, Senator Last probably knows this, but I'll just say it for the record, that there is money that's being transferred from the Attorney General's office to public safety as a rider for prosecutors, but that's there would be no double dipping. That's just because of the fact that there's this language and they need to make that transfer and then to cancel that that rider so that there's not this ongoing language. So I was assured, and I did talk to Nancy Haas, who represents the county attorneys and others, that there's no double dipping. So that will dissipate, for lack of better word.
Senator Lance.
Okay. Madam Chair, I appreciate that clarification. So the $65,000 becomes zero after all the accounting is straightened out?
Yes.
Okay. And I'll just point out for members' information also that the $200,000 in the OJP on line 158 for prosecutor law enforcement training out of Senate File 1846 is complemented also by the same training for the public defenders on line 77. Which it just shows up in a different portion of the budget here, but the public defenders are included in the overall training that's contemplated. Now, these are, I guess I'll say, these are public employees, and typically the ongoing education for public employees is covered by public expenses. I'm not sure if OJP is the right place for that to be paid for, frankly, but, it's those private sector folks. No matter what profession you're in, I think we have to bear our own education expenses to keep our licensure. That's probably what it comes down to.
All right, anybody else? Any other members on anything in the bill? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, my hat's off to you for enduring 3 hours of what I would think is rather grueling testimony. I've been there myself, and so I appreciate the work you've done in the bill. Having said that, I did want to make some observations about the bill that kind of have complicated our work and kind of used public funds for purposes that I think I at least question. You know, at first, I bring up the same concerns that Senator Newman brings up about some of the, what I would call sizable salary increases from year to year. Some of them, many of them, range in the 8 to 10% range over the biennium. Split in half, that's 4 to 5% per year. It seems a little high to me for that type of application. I haven't heard the justification for large increases like that, other than the fact that there was some past years that we did not have surpluses, so therefore we need to make up back salaries for some reason. I come from a different world than public life. I sell real estate. I earn my living based on commissions. And when there's circumstances in the market that don't allow me to make as many sales in 1 year versus the year before, and when the times get better, I work a little harder, and I hope to make up that, but there's no guarantee that I'm going to be made up any back salary because of the job I have. And quite honestly, I think state employees have to realize that there's circumstances beyond our state fiscal control that affect our budgets, affect our revenue streams, and that incomes, just like the private sector, are not as secure as perhaps they once were. Something happens in the Mideast, the price of gasoline goes up, and now it intrudes into someone's family budget. And they can't advance as far as they would like as a family because of the added costs. The salary increase, some of the salary increases, some of the 1.8% per year, are actually on top of collective bargaining agreements that already have salary increases that are already on track. And so now, and I know this was a recommendation from the governor down, that all government agencies in certain classifications would get a 1.8% increase. And that was added onto everyone's budget that we're now discussing. Those salary increases, the way I see them, could have restored the BCA initiatives for the governor's recommendation. If we did not recognize him, we could restore the Department of Corrections fugitive apprehension agents because of those salary increases. And before your amendment, we could have restored the $11 million disaster relief if we didn't recognize some of the salary increases that are already getting salary increases due to collective bargaining. And so as I look at it, I really wish that we could supply the BCA with the initiatives that they request. And the Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension agents have come here many years in a row asking for help in gaining the ability to keep up to their workload. And so I'm concerned about their safety. I know they try to get law enforcement to help them, to supplement them when they're making an arrest. Sometimes timing just doesn't allow that, and they have to move quickly. And that, on top of all of that, that could have restored the MinCorps and fire safety account transfer as well. And so that's the impact that the salary requirement in this bill is now impacting the rest of our justice initiatives. And so that's the only concern I have. It's the only comment I want to make. And I think sometimes it's better to leave the collective bargaining system as far away from us as possible and let it do its thing. And just because we have a surplus, we don't throw an added salary incentive onto the top of it without going through that system.
Mr. Turner, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that if it's a 1.8% increase, and let's say the bargaining units bargain for 2% or 2.5% per year, then that difference has to come out of the agency budget. It's not on top of, so it wouldn't be a 2.5 on top of a 1.8. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
I almost want to note the irony here that the complaint now is that we're not expanding government enough. The complaint by Senator Limmer is that we are only we're not giving 100% of the increase in government that's asked for. We're only giving half of it, and that's not enough. I mean, we've had lots of conversations over the years in this Capitol claiming concerns about, you know, what you're not really cutting anything. You're just cutting the increases, so you can't claim that you're cutting. Okay, so we're cutting the increase here, but the shoe's on the other foot this time. So I don't think it's fair to say that, that we could have done everything else that, you know, is suggested, you know, give the BCA everything that they want. If we simply, you know, wouldn't do this 1.8% increase or simply wouldn't give public employees, you know, the 4 or 5% increase. And let's be very clear here. There's only, I think, two very small line items here where the employees are getting a 5 and 5. Maybe it's just one. I know the guardian ad litems are getting that, but they're not getting everything else that they asked for either. And that's unique because there was a transition there that was necessary to make it work. And the courts, and I've said this before, and I'll defend them till the end of the day, 4% and 4% for the courts. It's number one, it's less than they asked for, which would have been more appropriate, the 5 and the 5, which would have been fair given the lack of increases that they got, while other state employees were still getting some increases. So it's not a matter of making up for the holes from previous years completely, but what it is saying is when other state employees were getting increases in their take-home compensation because they had the availability for step increases in their positions, and for a shorter period of time, when they were frozen in their salaries for only 4 years, the courts were frozen for 5 years in everything. No step increases, no salary increases. All right, so I don't, just as to parity between government employees, the 4% and 4% is fully justified for the courts. And I want to go back to the question about the Human Rights Department, too. You know, you can talk about percentages, but, you know, if I've got one bottle of apple juice here and I get another bottle of apple juice, I got 100% increase, okay, but I'm still only one bottle of apple juice, you know, richer, right? So Department of Human Rights is one of our absolutely smallest agencies in state government, and they deal with an absolutely important issue dealing with people's sense of self-worth and value and treatment in the workplace, which is frankly where most people spend more time than they spend in any other single place in their lives, is in the workplace. And oftentimes the only place they have to go to try to get some remedy if they feel they've been discriminated against in violation of our anti-discrimination laws, and I think we're all going to stand here and say those are very, very important. The only place they can go, or one of the only places, is to the Department of Human Rights. And often they have to wait a whole year to get an answer. All right. So, I'm not going to make any apologies for adding 7 investigators to the Department of Human Rights when they already have such a small staff as it is. And we're adding a lot more than that to the BCA in terms of absolute numbers in this budget that's proposed. Is there more need out there? Sure. There are other areas in which I'd like to see more government services provided. But we can't expand government as much as some people would like to in every situation. But for the government we have an obligation to try to make it work as well as we possibly can. And that's what this budget's about.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, I hope I've, over the years, given you an impression that I have a soft spot for this budget, especially when we were in majority control. During a time when we had a $5 to $6 billion shortfall, this budget went up. And it went up because we tried to adequately fund every need we possibly could, and we justified it because it was a constitutional requirement in our state to make sure that we do every effort we can to fund the safety and the justice prerogatives of this government. We now are in a time period of a surplus budget, and even by your own admission, we don't have enough coming from the governor's office to give us the direction to satisfy all of our needs. And so I understand the difficulty you have in making a budget. Believe me, we really had a difficulty back then when we had that sizable deficit. And thanks to you and the bipartisan effort that we developed, we held firm. I think it was close to a 10% increase that year that we got for the judiciary budget, and it gave them great relief because of the shortages that were created by that previous administration that I have no hesitancy to criticize during at least with the judiciary budget and how they applied the financial decisions of that administration. We've heard from others today saying in a time of surplus they were confused why they couldn't get their funds that were what they thought was somewhat reserved based on previous legislation. So I understand the difficulty that we have. I guess I'm just dissatisfied a little bit because there's some of these what I think is pretty important initiatives that haven't been filled. And that's it. I don't want to make this a gripe session. I don't want to pile on anything. You've had a very challenging process to make sure that we satisfy whatever the targets were that you were given, and we'll have to live with them.
Madam Chair, I want to thank the members of the committee for their work on this bill. I did circulate my proposal around to the committee a day before, yesterday afternoon, 2 days ago now, before it was posted publicly so I could receive input. And I did receive input from some members of the committee, and I appreciate that. This is the final product that we have before us, and I ask for the committee's support.
Thank you, Senator Latz. On that, Senate File 406, as amended, recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, we need to pass the spreadsheet as well as the vote.
Okay. On the spreadsheet that has been amended for Senate File 406, it's recommended to be passed. You want to make the motion or do you want me to? Go ahead, Senator Latz.
I move that the spreadsheet as amended for Senate File 406 be recommended to pass and be sent to the full Finance Committee.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, everybody in the room, for your patience on this and for your testimony and your help in and putting this together.
Get a new partner.
We get to tag team.
All right.
Policy bill.
Yep.
Do we at this point need to adjourn the Finance Committee and go open up as the Policy Committee?
No, Madam Chair. Senate File 878 is a fiscal jacket, so it's in the Finance Division. even though we're going to put only policy onto it.
All right.
It needs to stay in this division. I would like to go do some more possible. Only question, basically, is all these bills.
And that would be Senate File 878. And I do believe you have a delete all amendment to this one as well. All right.
This is not legal.
You and I.
I forgot.
No, if you're going to pass. I was going to leave this one. I was going to leave this with you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, this must have stayed.
Here's the delete all amendment. In case people have questions.
That's what I'm looking for.
I must have your bills there. There's no general fund impact. And this one is real easy because Martin's fungible.
I think
that's just transport through funds for Trunk Highway and Trunk Highway Forfeiture. Okay. This one, there is a cost to the forfeiture fund of $96,000. That's the storage cost for innocent owners.
We have an amendment on this?
For 60 days. Check the forfeiture fund balance. It can account.
The woman has three proposals.
Okay.
One that works, two that don't.
Yeah, that's fine. That's the only thing you're going to stick around for.
Oh, I heard somewhat about those.
Ken and I have to.
So one works, two of them don't.
He said if we do all three,
I want to get started.
Vote for it.
Yes.
I didn't hear him say that.
That's what we'll do. We'll finance tomorrow.
Yeah. One just work. Two won't work.
As quick as possible.
I'd have to see him.
Okay. All right. Is he putting those the in committee now? Will come back to order. Senate File 878. Senator Latz, the Judiciary Policy Bill. And you want to start out with the A1 Delete All Amendment?
I do. I move the A1 Delete All Amendment.
Okay, to put the bill in the shape that Senator Latz wants it. We will vote on the A1 Delete All Amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Now to the A1 Amendment, Senator Latz, you have an A6 Amendment.
Move the adoption of the A6 Amendment, members. This makes adjustments to one provision of the bill, which relates to the outside agency investigation for police officer-related deaths or great bodily harm.
All right, members, on the A6 amendment to the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Latz.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, this is what I propose to be the omnibus criminal justice or public safety bill, policy bill. And it incorporates the following individual Senate files. Senate File 405, of which I'm the chief author, the misdemeanor default bill. Senate File 1299, Senator Dibble, the drone bill. And I can go into a little more specifics, but I'm just going to highlight these right now. Senate File 466, characterized as the Police and Community Confidence Act investigations related to peace officer-related incidents. Senate File 994, also my bill, the Juvenile Justice Act. Senate File 385, Senator Newman's bill and forfeiture law modification. Senate File 384, also Senator Newman's bill, the forfeiture burden of proof shift and homestead exemption expansion. And Senate File 355, Senator Champion's bill, the voting restoration bill. That's the felony voting bill.
I take it back, Senator Newman. You have a lot of power. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, there are a lot of other bills that have come through this committee that are not included here. We've taken the bills that are within the criminal justice public safety theme, so there aren't any civil, any more generic civil law bills in here. There are some other bills that we've heard in this committee that are going to be tracking separately. There's a separate DWI bill, which will proceed on its own. There's a separate license plate reader bill that will proceed on its own. There's a separate body camera bill that will proceed on its own, and a variety of others as well. So what you have before you, I just will summarize briefly and then tell you where there are changes to what has already been heard by this committee, so we don't spend a lot of time just rehashing what we've already done in this committee. The misdemeanor default bill, this is a bill Actually, maybe what I'll do is, I'm sure what's the easiest way to do is to run through jackets that we have in front of us. Maybe I'll just tell you basically what we're doing in the order of the bills I described. The misdemeanor default bill, this is the bill that provides any legislation that is passed that does not specify a penalty but criminalizes an act or prohibits an act. Under current law, new bills that we pass that way automatically become petty misdemeanors. We took care of that last year. However, there are 79 statutes that currently fall within the misdemeanor default crimes that are an existing law that we did not address retroactively last year. Actually, there are more, but 79 of them have actually been prosecuted as misdemeanors in the last 10 years in the state of Minnesota, according to the records of the court, the judicial branch. So this would take those misdemeanors and make them petty misdemeanors. They were made misdemeanors without any specific consideration by the judiciary committees when they were passed is the general theme here. And the idea is that when we create a crime, we ought to do it very consciously as by committee action rather than just by default. So if in the future anyone wishes to convert any of these particular petty misdemeanors back into misdemeanors, it can be done, but through a bill that is heard by this committee. So that it's a conscious and public understanding. Senate File 1299, Senator Dibble's drone bill. This basically addresses, and there are no changes proposed in what's before the committee tonight for this bill, but it basically sets some warrant requirements and restrictions on the use of drones by law enforcement. Senate File 466 relating to investigations of peace officer-related deaths or great bodily harm. There is a proposed change to what we already considered in this committee. This has come after I've received a fair amount of feedback from a number of different sources in response to the bill. So since we first introduced the bill, we have learned basically that there are only two agencies that conduct their own internal investigations, Minneapolis and St. Paul. All other agencies, even Duluth, Bloomington, all the other bigger agencies, and even the smallest of agencies, they go to outside agencies when they have a police officer-related incident that, frankly, is too sensitive or touchy or creates the appearance of a conflict of interest if they were to investigate it themselves. That would be including most particularly shootings that result in the death of a citizen that the police have come into contact with, shootings by the police officer. So the whole point of the bill was to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest in the outcome of that investigation, and thereby to restore, enhance, ensure the confidence of the community in the results of that investigation, whichever way the investigation turns out. In response to the feedback I've gotten on the bill, I think it is most appropriate to leave the provisions in the bill the same as they relate to just an outside agency must conduct the investigation rather than specifying that outside agency. However, with regard to Minneapolis and St. Paul, I'm no longer comfortable with the notion of simply leaving up to them the choice of an outside agency because of a concern that has been raised to me on a number of fronts were they to agree to, on an ongoing basis, investigate each other's incidents, which, by the way, I'm aware at least one community does not want to do, but if they were to do that, it could create the appearance that you've got one hand washing the other every time there's an incident. And that would undermine the entire goal of this bill. So what I propose now before you, and that was with that amendment and that we put on to put the bill in the shape that I'd like the members to consider it, is for Minneapolis and St. Paul would be required to have the BCA conduct the investigation. In my judgment, the BCA is fully capable of conducting the investigation. They conduct investigations all across the state of a similar nature when those incidents arise. The BCA has informed me that they feel fully confident in them conducting these investigations. They are located in the metro area, so when there are issues of response times, they can respond very promptly, you know, to get to the scene of an incident. And I know that was one of the great concerns about whether a local agency should be forced to go outside to have an investigation conducted. So before you for consideration, then, is a bill that would require Minneapolis and St. Paul to have the BCA conduct the investigation. There is a small fiscal impact of that, which we carry in the budget bill. My recollection is it's $18,000 if in the budget bill that we just passed to cover the costs relating to that by the BCA. Other than that, because the BCA is already doing this kind of work, they feel that they can handle any investigations that would come their way. So that's that bill. The Juvenile Justice Act is Senate File 994 that's in here. It is in the same shape as this committee passed it before, as I recall. I'm just going to check with Mr. Backus. Am I speaking correctly on that one, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, members, were you talking about the Juvenile Justice?
Juvenile Justice Act.
Those provisions are exactly the same.
With regard to the two forfeiture bills authored by Senator Newman, there are also no changes in those bills as they relate to what we've already passed. And with regard to Senator Champion's bill on felony voter restoration, there is also no change there. You know, this bill, you know, it could be carried in a couple of different places. My understanding is that it was to be in Senator Sieben's bill as well, but if we carry it in this bill, then I anticipate she probably will not carry it forward in her bill. So this would be the place for that provision to move forward as well. Members, I think this gives the Senate the best chance of enacting legislation this legislative session that this committee has already voted in favor of, and hence... hence the reason we have an omnibus bill containing these particular provisions. Happy to answer your questions and ask for your support.
We have nobody scheduled to testify, but would anybody like to come up and speak on the bill?
We have a couple amendments, right? Amendments.
We have, Mr. Race.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice, Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. I was told earlier there were still several other law enforcement groups that were going to testify, but I guess I'll leave that up to them. This bill has changed. The committee heard it several weeks ago, and it was in one form, and then
bill are you referring to?
This bill, Section 3, excuse me, thank you, Senator. Section 3 of the bill on officer-involved shooting, page 5. Senator, was your amendment added?
Yes.
Thank you. So the bill that was heard in committee several weeks ago had any officer-involved shooting had to be involved, it be investigated by a different law enforcement agency. We testified, the Police Officer Federation, Mr. Lieutenant Delmonico, and I testified at that hearing and felt that the Minneapolis Police Department has the most expertise in investigating matters like this. There hadn't been any evidence introduced or examples given that there was something corrupt or inappropriate with the police department, no cases where they'd improperly investigated matter. There certainly was testimony about perception on whether it was appropriate or not to have those departments do their own work. We disagree on that point. We understand that perception could enter into this, but we would urge the committee to just legislate on perception alone is not the best way to proceed in legislating. So That was the bill in committee. Then there was a draft that came out of the bill yesterday that would have had all agencies in the state, officer-involved shooting, officer-involved incidents, investigated by the BCA. And now today, with the amendment, Minneapolis and St. Paul are being singled out and referred directly to the BCA. We think that that calls out Minneapolis and St. Paul, but I'll only speak for Minneapolis, for some special consideration. We think that's wrong and unfair. Again, we think that the Minneapolis Police Department, again, remember, what this is just an investigation. Ultimately, that investigation has to go to a county attorney. If a county attorney doesn't like the investigation, believes something's wrong, that the investigation wasn't done, they could send it back to the agency that did the initial investigation, or they could call for additional investigation. And the presumption on this is that cops are dirty and the cops are covering up for each other. I mean, let's just put that on the table. That's the perception. That's what the advocates on this believe. And now Minneapolis and St. Paul are being called out specifically and said, send your cases to the BCA. And we just think that that's wrong. It creates the wrong impression. It basically puts for lack of a better word, a stain on the Minneapolis Police Department and their officers. We think it's unfair. We think that there's no record for doing that and saying that. And if you were going to do anything, we think it would be much more fair to just simply apply this law equally to all police departments in the state that said if you have an officer-involved incident, the investigation should be done by an agency other than your own, if that's to answer that concern. Directing it to the BCA, again, we'd say is just simply wrong, and it's calling out Minneapolis Police Department for something that we don't think should happen. And I'll just close on this point. I know that this involves more than shootings, but NPR did a study, and there were 63 shootings by police officers of citizens over about an eight-year period. And the numbers were 29, 17, 11, and 4. And the regions that were under consideration were St. Paul, Minneapolis, the suburbs, and greater Minnesota. And many people said, oh, it must be Minneapolis cops shoot 29 people. Well, wrong. It was four citizens were shot, killed by Minneapolis police officers in that period, the fewest of those four regions. St. Paul had 11. The suburbs had 29, and greater Minnesota had 17. And I would argue, at least if you're looking to be, where are you at risk for an officer not doing his job or not exercising control and doing it, it's not in Minneapolis, despite whatever reputation people seem to think. And quite frankly, when I asked legislators that question, I found only one person who got it right, because they think the Minneapolis cops are bad. They're not. They're excellent police officers. They've handled a lot of situations, including some recently where one police officer was shot and injured, and also one who was shot at in northeast Minneapolis, and the police officers did not return fire and arrested the person. So, again, I don't think the bill is fair in the way it calls out Minneapolis, and we think there's ought to be a better remedy.
Thank you, Mr. Reyes. Anyone else on this issue? State your name, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Lesh, and I am here on behalf of the City of Minneapolis. And we just wanted to be on the record concurring with the statements that Mr. Reyes just presented to the committee on behalf of the Federation, that the city holds the same opinion. And I think that he outlined a lot of our concerns and our perspective as well. So I think he said it perfectly, and we just want to be on the record as supporting the Federation in agreement on this, that that the city and the police department should have the same ability as other jurisdictions around the state to make the determination on a case-by-case basis when an incident arises what the appropriate outside jurisdiction is, and that the incidents are not one-size-fits-all. The BCA might be the appropriate entity in many situations, but maybe not all situations. And to be able to have that that flexibility to make those determinations is important. So with that, I would just stand for questions and turn it over to St. Paul.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Commander Mary Nash, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of Chief Smith and the St. Paul Police Department. We support the concept of outside investigations for officer-involved incidents. We do have confidence in the BCA, but have concerns being limited by statute to one agency for such an important investigation. BCA has always been a great partner to us in law enforcement, yet officer-involved incidents can be complex and resource-intensive. Some concerns are response times to begin an investigation, number of investigators that can respond. For us currently, when we respond to such incidents, we have between 4 and 6 investigators that can work such a case. We believe having the flexibility to utilize an outside agency, utilizing our law enforcement partners, gives us the best opportunity for an objective investigation.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these two members? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And please sign in, if you would. Anyone else? Kathy Haney and Jim Franklin. Ms. Haney.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz Committee, my name is Kathy Haney. I'm a lawyer from Fagery Baker Daniels, and I represent the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We support the concept of outside investigations for officer-involved incidents. We, too, support the BCA in their ability to handle investigations, and quite honestly, I've listened to several of my chiefs talk about the skill and ability and efficiency and timeliness with which the BCA has done several of their investigations. So that is just not the issue. We are concerned about a statutory process requirement that would mandate how two of our members would conduct their investigations and what their options would be, and so do agree with the previous speakers on that issue. And we also are more, I don't know if concerned is a little stronger, a little more uncertain about the great bodily harm language and how much that would add to what started out as an officer-involved shooting, and so how many more incidents that would be, and would have to query the committee and the author whether we should think about starting back where we did with officer-involved shootings, especially as we work through this whole process, which will be relatively new for everybody. So that would be just a question. We'd like to continue to work with you on that issue, but again, we want to be clear that we do support outside investigations for officer-involved incidents. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haney. Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair and members, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. I'll try to be brief and just make a couple of points. The first point I would like to say is thank you to the Senator for putting the bill together. I think we, as law enforcement, collectively owe him an apology for not getting our act together and being able to come together and agree upon this. This has been a very difficult issue. And I just want you to know that we're working through those issues, and I think the Senator has done a great job, and I wish we would have been able to do a little bit better for him. Secondly,
There's still time.
I'm working my way there, sir. Okay. Secondly, we do support the bill, as has been amended. We understand what the Senator said with regards to two specific agencies and the public appearance. And I understand that, and I give that some merit. I would call your attention to one word on line 5.20. In that word, it says, if I understand correctly, investigation must be conducted by the BCA. The word must. In my previous life, I was an emergency management planner and speculator on disaster and other kinds of things. One of the things that we did in my past life was to speculate a town called New Orleans and the probability of that ever flooding. I don't have to tell you the rest of that story, and that was multiple years before the event. My only reason to relate this is this bill says it must be BCA. And in the worst case scenario, BCA has multiple shootings simultaneously and cannot handle the investigation. And we have a situation in which we have an investigation that needs to be conducted, hence one of the criticisms that came out of Ferguson, Missouri. So if I had any recommendation at all, is there a way that something could be added at some point in time that should BCA not be able to carry out that investigation for some reason, there is an alternative source We have several sheriff's offices in the state and others that do conduct these investigations, and I would hate to see us backed into a box with this one word. My second point, I would like to just suggest, and I've talked very briefly with Senate counsel on this particular issue, is the definition of great bodily harm in 609.02 sub 8, and specifically the last four words of that statute, which are other serious bodily harm. And I did some analytical work with case law and have a number of cases from the appellate court in which, and I won't bore you with that, but which they have articulated unconscious hospitalization, suffering, numbness, dizziness. In aggregate, if you add those things together, they fall into that category of other serious bodily harm. And I'm just wondering if a tweak could be made, because I understand the intent of 609.02, but perhaps a reference in some way to exclude those last four words from that statutory reference of 609 sub 2 sub 8 and exclude those last four words, which I think would get you to the intent of where the senator wishes to go and would not get us in conflict with appellate and other Supreme Court decisions that have been rendered previously. And I just would like to suggest some maybe word there that might be able to work that out, and then I think we're home with a good bill.
What word is that?
I would just, it was said.
I know what he's referring to. Madam Chair, I know what he's referring to in the definition of great bodily harm, and I'm willing to work with Mr. Franklin and others to try to figure out a way to address the concern. I'm not sure we can craft the language here on the fly for that.
Correct.
And also the concern about the BCA. If they need more help, basically, what do they do? Do they have the ability to call in other agencies for assistance or to turn it over to someone else? And I'm open to working on that, too. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Franklin. Anybody else like to comment on the policy bill? Seeing none, members? Senator Newman?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've got two amendments that I'm going to offer.
All right.
May I ask, Madam Chair, to this bill or to some other portion of the bill?
To this section? To this section, no.
Okay. May I just, with regard to this section, before we move on to a different topic then, I have asked stakeholders to provide me with some suggestions about collaborative work if there was some concern about an outside agency not being able to get to a scene quickly enough. Whether an investigation could be started by an agency on site and have the BCA come in and take it over, or some outside agency come in and take it over, supplement it, whatever. I have not received any suggestions for language on how to handle that kind of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a moving target. Every time I come up with a proposal, I say, we're okay with the concept, but we got these problems, 1, 2, and 3, and then those problems are so bad that they can't support the bill. What I'm proposing is not targeted at any particular agencies. I'm not suggesting that Minneapolis is a lousy police force or anything. I believe to the contrary. They've got an excellent police force. But every police force has a couple of incidents where there's misjudgment used. I don't think anyone can stand up in here. No agency can say they're holier than thou and saints, and there's not going to ever be any incidents of that nature with individual members of an organization. And I think the worst thing for public perception, whether you've got a current outcry or not, is the concern that some are going back, that the person in the break room is the one that's investigating the person they're sitting at the table having lunch with. It raises all sorts of questions about whatever the results of the investigation are. So perception is very, very powerful in these kinds of situations. It can be the difference between a riot and property destruction and more injury or death, and public acceptance of how a situation is being handled. And that's what my goal is here, is to avoid that perception and So far, no one else has come up with a solution. Not even a collaboration between individual agencies has been able to make any headway. So we're still in session. I'd like to make headway on the issue.
All right. Thank you, Senator Lass.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, two amendments that I'm going to offer, and it specifically is with respect to Article 4, the restoration of right to vote. Prior to the hearing today, I provided copy of the proposed amendments to Senator Champion as a matter of courtesy, so that he knows, you know, what I am going to be offering. The first one I am going to offer would be the A3 amendment.
And we do not
they're coming, Madam Chair.
Okay, it's coming. Page 32, we're on members, line 12.
Madam Chair, when this bill was heard here in this committee, I remember a exchange between Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman and myself with respect to the work release program. And the question that I had for Mr. Freeman was whether or not it's clear that an individual who is released for purposes of going to work during the day is still covered or restricted in terms of his right to vote. And Mr. Freeman felt that he indeed would be restricted. I'm not so sure, members, that the language in the bill is as crystal clear as Mr. Freeman suggested. And specifically, if we go on to subdivision 2A on page 32, the language talks in terms of when an individual completes any incarceration imposed. And then in the next line on line 32.9 talks in terms of during any period following conviction in which the individual is not incarcerated. Now, I believe that the intent is to include individuals who are in work release. But I don't think it's much of a stretch that an attorney would be able to make an argument that the individual was not, in fact, incarcerated at the time that he presented himself to vote and had been released. So the purpose of the A3 amendment is to simply clear up what I believe to be an ambiguity, and frankly would be as much to protect the public in terms of voting rights as the individual who is involved in the work release program, so that that individual who is involved in the work release program would not have any confusion on this issue as to whether or not the right to vote has been restored because he was released from incarceration for the purpose of going to work. So that, in essence, Madam Chair, is the amendment, the A3, which I offer at this time.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Senator Newman for his thoughtfulness around this, you know, bill. And the A3 amendment, we will see as a friendly amendment. This really only clarifies what we testified to before this committee and every other committee, I believe. And so with that being said, I will see the A3 as a friendly amendment.
All right, any questions for members on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I would next offer the A5 amendment.
Okay. We will be, I assume, yep, getting that. All right, members, this is on page 32, section 1.
Madam Chair, members, the A5 amendment is also an amendment that I had provided to Senator Champion prior to the hearing today. And candidly, the restoration of right to vote bill as drafted is one that I have not supported during this session. And Senator Champion and I we've visited about it. And I was hoping that it would be a bill that would move forward as a standalone bill. I know that it has also been included in the elections omnibus bill. But I had hoped that it would proceed as a standalone bill because I think this is a significant and important public policy issue and is most certainly worthy of a discussion. And I think that there are going to be folks on both sides of this issue, some in support, some opposed. And when we find it included in an omnibus bill, now it becomes a lot more difficult to handle because, as with all omnibus bills, there are portions that we support and there are portions that we do not support. So as to the A5 amendment, it in reality encompasses three different parts. The first part says that if a person is released from incarceration before the restoration of right to vote can be restored, the individual has to complete 2 years of being on probation before the right to vote is being restored. And that would be true, members, whether the person comes out of the prison system of being released from incarceration, whether they come out of a local jail type setting, or if upon conviction, either by a plea or by a jury, the judge simply orders that the execution of the sentence is stayed and they immediately be placed on probation. So that's the first part. Second part is that the individual during the period of probation, and of course at whatever during whatever time period the convicted felon wishes, that they complete any specific terms and conditions of the probation. Oftentimes a court will impose a fine. The court may impose victims being paid back a certain amount of money. Sometimes there are subrogation claims. Individual might be required during probation to complete community service. I think it's entirely reasonable to require an individual who is on probation and is making the very public statement that they want to be reintegrated into the community and be a meaningful participant in our society, at a minimum be willing to pay the fine or pay the victim in terms of what the victim is owed or complete the community service, whatever the court may order in terms of special circumstances to be completed during the period of probation. Third part is that during the two-year period of time that the person would have to serve on probation before having the right to vote restored, they would not be in violation of any of the terms of the probation. Those are essentially the three parts to the amendment. And I'm candidly hoping that this will be accepted as a friendly amendment. I will tell you, Madam Chair and members, it is a sincere effort on my part to find some kind of common ground to where the restoration of the right of felons to vote can be acceptable. And very honestly, in its current form, I simply cannot agree to the article as written in this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Newman, for, you know, your recitation and really talking about this important piece of legislation. One of the reasons why the article is drafted the way it is because it seeks to provide individuals an opportunity to vote and for there to be a bright line. That bright line is very important because, you know, when people have a bright line, then they're able to really be very clear and definitive about what they can and cannot do. That's why I oppose your A5 amendment, is because it adds more confusion. When you start thinking about when a person can vote, when they have to pay a fine, when they have to do all these other things, it adds barriers and conditions, and it adds confusion to even court personnel. Who is going to keep up with when the timeline starts all over again and some of the other conditions that are articulated in your A5 amendment? It drives costs. This is something that is occurring, or what you're asking to be conditions for a person to vote while these people are or individuals are paying taxes and they're raising families and they're conducting themselves as productive citizens. And we want to encourage pro-social activities. And so I think it is a sincere attempt, and I take you at your word, and I am thankful for you showing me these amendments before I sat down here today, and I sincerely appreciate that. But because it seems to extract from the life of the bill by putting forth these things that you have laid forward, I am asking the committee to oppose the A5 amendment. And I believe Julie Struthers is here from the Secretary of State's office, and maybe from the Secretary of State's perspective, she can also speak to this proposed amendment as well.
Ms. Struthers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would echo a lot of what Senator Champion said. From an elections administration perspective, having a clear and bright line as to who is eligible to vote and who is not has been something that we've heard from our cities and counties as they train election judges. From our perspective, as we work to make sure right now to mark the voter rolls with those who have been convicted of a felony, I don't know how we would go about administering this, and if we could even get lists from the Department of Corrections about who has been out 2 years but then has met all their requirements, I don't know how we would practically go about administering this. And one of the real benefits that I know that the cities and county officials who administer elections see in this bill is the clear, bright line so that they can train election judges and they don't have the confusion that we already have at the polls under the current system. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but mostly echoing what Senator Champion said.
All right. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Julie, can you tell me how you administer it now? How do you know whether somebody can vote or not vote now? How do you deal with the records or allow the judges to make those decisions?
Ms. Struthers.
Madam Chair, Senator, we get lists from the Department of Corrections, and we also get lists from the courts about who is on probation for a felony sentence, though we know that those lists are not perfect, that they are not, you know, they're a snapshot in time. So at the time people show up at the polls, they're not always correct and up to date, and we do a lot of training for election judges about, you know, what questions to ask. But it becomes really complicated when it turns out, you know, there's a difference between a stay of adjudication versus a stay of imposition. And under one, you can vote, and under the other, you might not be able to. And those are conversations that are hard for election judges to have with voters and are not within their area of expertise. And so oftentimes, because there's not a bright line rule, people end up leaving the polling place. We have a hotline that we have people that they can call to try to confirm their status, but it ends up being very murky for a lot of folks, even though we try our best to get the best information out there for Election Day.
Senator Hall.
Commander Chair. And so with this amendment, it wouldn't be any more murky. It would still be murky, so it would be similar to what we have now, except that we would have those that would be felons able to vote after 2 years. So it'd still be murky. We're allowing a lot of felons after 2 years of probation to be able to vote.
Ms. Struthers.
Madam Chair, Senator, I mean, it certainly would add additional people who would be eligible to vote. I don't think it clarifies, though, for the election judge and for our office, how we identify where people are on the side of the line of being eligible or ineligible. In particular, right now we do get the list from the Department of Corrections and the courts about who's on probation for a felony, and we give that information to the counties. I don't know if it's even possible for the Department of Corrections and probation to have a list of who's been on probation for 2 years and have also completed their conditions of probation or supervised release. You know, there's a lot of different factors here, and so I think it does add to the confusion. It just keeps on adding layers on to the different things that judges would have to think about.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, so thank you, Madam Chair. So if it was just the 2 years, that would be a little easier for you to handle, because you could get those that have been out of prison, and as long as it's been 2 years past that, that would be an easier line, is all I'm trying to say.
But Senator Hall, it also requires that all the fines be paid up and other intervening
variables.
Well,
if that
variables.
Wasn't a part of it.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Ms. Druthers.
Madam Chair, Senator, from an election administration perspective, I think the real benefit to our cities and counties in training judges and administering the elections is they know that if someone is out of custody, they are eligible to vote.
Right.
And so having to then have that discussion, has it been 2 years, all of that, just it takes away a lot of the benefits from an administration perspective and a confidence perspective at the polls.
All right, members, I think we're ready to vote on this.
Chair, question.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Champion, if I could ask you a question, since this is your provision in the bill. I've been thinking about this issue, and I need you to answer, what is the goal of giving felons the right to vote once they're beyond incarceration? What was the ultimate goal that, or the social good that we're trying to accomplish?
Madam Chair.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Senator Lemmer, for that thoughtful question. The goal is multidimensional. There's a belief that if an individual who is back in the community and is allowed to participate in what we are calling pro-social activities, there are good outcomes. One, empirical data seems to suggest that when an individual is gainfully employed, that's a positive outcome because they are busy, they're being a contributing member not only to themselves but also to their family. They're also paying taxes. That's a benefit socially for us all, because if we have a number of responsible people participating in that exercise, that's helpful. But we also think that if a person is participating in the basic tenets of our democracy, then they feel much more invested and much more part of what's going on. If they're busy helping to make decisions as to school boards and any municipal elections, we also believe and empirical data seems to suggest that if the children of those adults see them voting, then their children are more than likely to also be voters. And certainly, if people are productive and doing the things that they need to be good role models for their family, they're not going back to prison. And if they're not going back to prison, then they're not on our tax roll and being more of a burden as opposed to being a contributing member of our society. So it's multidimensional. And I believe that people should have and participate in representation, especially if they're being taxed, if they're contributing members to our society. So it's not one goal, but it's multidimensional, and I hope I've answered your question.
Thank you, Senator Champion.
Senator Lemmer.
It was interesting that you said the first thing that came to your mind was to be socially responsible, and that the hope of a vote, the right to vote, would contribute to that. But I think of Senator Newman's amendment socially responsible. I would think the best example of being socially responsible would be to pay a fine or to pay the restitution to the person you victimized. And I think Senator Newman has a pretty good suggestion to that. What better way to prove that you're socially responsible than to pay the victim back for what you did to him or her? And so I think that's a legitimate qualification for someone to show that they are ready to be socially responsible.
This is one of those which came first, the chicken or the eggs discussions.
Senator Goodman.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I won't belabor this because we've been through this discussion a great deal. But I want to explain to Senator Newman why I will not be supporting his amendment. I think I said this during the original hearings, but and it's just a little different than what we've been talking here. It's a subtle difference. I think that we disagree about what extracting the right to vote is about and whether or not and what its purpose is in the first place. I think when somebody commits a crime, if they do time, there is a punishment to it. They're put in jail, they're given a fine, they're asked to pay a restitution. They might do something so serious that we think they have to be isolated and restrained from interaction with the general public for the purposes of punishment as well as public safety. And in the time that they are in that situation, they have restrictions on their ability to interact with general society. They can't see their families as often, if at all. They might sometimes be further isolated in that incarceration. Their calls might be limited. Their letters are reviewed. So while they're incarcerated, they experience a supervision to make certain that the public, that the others in the environment are safe, they're kept away from the public, so we're safe, and they're also paying a punishment. It is a punishment for a crime. But once they've come out of that boundary, we're moving away from, we're not into punishment anymore, we're into reintegration, then I don't understand why we continue to take away from a person those things that on every other level they are given back, which is the opportunity to interact with their society, with their family, with their friends, with their children. They can be employed. They can engage in those things that are about being a part of a community. And I think voting, it should be a part of that right from the beginning. I haven't even become clear about whether or not it should be a part of the punishment. I've said that before in here. I'm not even sure we should restrict their right to vote while they're in jail. I haven't gotten clear about that. But it's absolutely clear to me that they've done the isolation from society, and they're now moving back into society, why we would take this one thing and say it's the one thing that we won't allow you to do that's a part of reestablishing your place in society. And it's on that basis. It's not because it's easier for the voting, you know, to follow who's voting and who's not voting. All of those are secondary to it, but it really is a different principle for me and as to why I will not be supporting your amendment.
All right, members, I think we're ready to vote. On the A6 amendment? No, sorry.
Five.
A5 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Okay, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, if there are no other amendments, I move that Senate File 878, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the full Finance Committee.
All right. On Senator Latz's motion. Oh, Senator Dietz. Dietz.
It's more of a comment on the bill.
Whoever you are.
Yeah. I just thank you, Senator Latz, for putting this there. I'm going to speak briefly. I could have talked earlier, but I thought I'd wait till the end on the addition in here on the Minneapolis and St. Paul kind of being singled out. I appreciate what you're doing. I understand that perception is powerful, and I do believe perception becomes reality. But that being said, it also kind of having, I represent Minneapolis, So I'm going to, you know, stand up for Minneapolis here because I do think that they are a good police department. They're, you know, they're probably not perfect, but nobody is. And I just also have concerns that by singling them out here, there is also the perception that they are bad. And so I'm just going to state that. I'm still voting for the bill, but I just have serious concerns because why you're trying to address a perception issue that I agree with, I think by putting and singling out Minneapolis and St. Paul, we are potentially putting in a perception that they are bad because they're singled out. So I'm just raising my concerns and sharing them.
All right. Thank you, Senator Dzik. On the LATS motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Lassen. Thank you for all the work you've done on this. It's a lot of work. And I'm really glad I'm not the permanent chair. Oh, and with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.